power into it, but it also wants to drain away, so you can keep it for a couple of minutes. Uh-huh. You're not going to keep it for months.
Right, okay. So a rubbish battery.
Yeah, but it has its application in trying to actually balance things at a perfect millionth of a second.
Right, okay.
The Singapore government did a roadmap study, mm-hmm. and they came to the conclusion that batteries were the preferred form. It's just a question of what chemistry to use. Mm-hmm. Because batteries can be put in any weather, in any location, in any footprint. Like, you can have any shape. You don't have the logistical constraints of, say, you know, compressed air or flywheel bases or pumped hydro or anything like that. And what they don't understand is the sheer volume of power they need to operate. You know, they don't understand how much power that they need to actually store. So what's happened is everyone has collectively missed this basic problem.
The 2,100 terawatt.
Yeah. Yeah, the amount of is, and the fact that we don't really have a technology to store that much power for a long time. You've got, for example, 6 months of the year in, say, Berlin, in summer, you get lots of sun. It exceeds the average. Okay, you've got to collect that power and keep it for about 6 months, and then across winter, another 6 months, you've got to release it slowly to make up that shortfall.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're storing power for as, you know, sometimes 11 months. Right, and a lot of power. Yeah, and so, and the closer you get to the northern extreme poles, the more pronounced that difference actually is.
Right.
And wind has the problem of these massive peaks and lulls,
mm-hmm.
where a windstorm will come in and you'll have like a really, really high amplitude, but you can have a swing of up to 48% of capacity. Because then after that, you've got, like, say, a couple of days where there's no wind at all.
Yeah.
Even though it's a couple of days, the size of the peak dictates the amount of buffer you need. And mm-hmm. so I actually don't know how much buffer is needed for these systems, and I don't think anyone else does either.
Okay.
I've just sort of highlighted that this is a problem, we should look at it.
Yeah.
But the thing is, yeah.
But do we have, I mean, what is the battery field looking like? Are there mega batteries in development? Will it be possible in 5 years' time? And what are also the minerals? What would a mineral shortage do to the battery industry as well?
Everyone believes that lithium-ion batteries are the thing. Like, if you try and get a funding project through Europe in particular, they won't look at you unless you're talking lithium-ion chemistry. Right, so this is the problem. We don't have enough lithium. But the batteries' options are lithium, nickel, cobalt, aluminium oxide, or NCA+, lithium, nickel, manganese, cobalt oxides, or NMCs, like NMCA11 or NMC532, lithium phosphate, LFP, or solid-state batteries. And solid-state batteries all require lithium. And then okay. you've got vanadium redox batteries. And so it's a combination of something in there, and there's like the IEA have released a market share of what they think 2040 and 2050 would look like. And so that's what I use to predict the future. The thing is, the sheer number of batteries is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Elon Musk, for example, released a podcast about a week ago where he can now make batteries without lithium, and he's doing it with a variation of NMC532 chemistry. So, okay, amazing. Good on you, mate. Good. But he now needs nickel, manganese, and cobalt to do that. So lithium and cobalt, and cobalt, both have shortfall profiles in the battery space because the sheer number of what we're looking at. So now we're back to a battery mineral shortage. But here's the thing. We can make batteries out of something else. You don't have to use this stuff. You can make them out of sodium. There's a guy here in Finland that's making them out of table salt. So these things are often, you know, waste products. Everyone likes the idea, but no one wants to look at these systems. They want lithium ion chemistry instead. It's like what we've put out. It's sexy. It's literally a group thing.
Yeah, okay.
Because you've got to build a market value chain around a new chemistry. It doesn't just happen.
Mm-hmm.
You need to source the minerals, turn it into something useful like a metal or a chemical, and a manufacturing plant to turn it into a battery. Then the mm-hmm. battery has to be suitable in an engineering state to be used in technology. And everyone knows what to do with lithium ion chemistry. batteries, but they don't know what to do with, say, a sodium battery yet. There's lots of talky-talky, but not a lot of wickety-whack. And that's a problem across the board. So the recycling stuff, there are recycling options in terms of technology, but the problem in recycling is not the technology itself, it's collection. Mm-hmm. How do you get the right residue into the right process plant? That's the challenge. There's an interesting statistic. Most mobile phones have not been collected for recycling. Most people have their old mobile phone in a drawer somewhere.
Yeah.
95% are in a drawer somewhere, right? And if you're not going to get enough together in a mass, it's not worthwhile to recycle. And then recycling the stuff out of a mobile phone is really complex because they're quite complex devices. Yeah. Yeah. And so it's not economical. So they just generally go for the gold, the platinum, and the silver, and they just leave the rest into landfill. So what we do is, instead of trying to actually flog ourselves to find more power storage, we develop an electrical engineering technology that can cope with variable power. And so it's tough enough that can survive, for example, frequency fluctuations and power spikes. And sometimes there's no power at all. Sometimes there is. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So if we can actually sort of have a technology like a computer that could survive that, then we forego the need of the power buffer. It's a tough ask. So instead of having one big seamless grid, could we have several grids that do different things?
Mm-hmm.
Like we might have like a highly intermittent grid whose purpose is to produce hydrogen. Right. And in that producing hydrogen, sometimes it's on, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's going really well, sometimes it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's an industrial application that will chew a lot of power. Charging of batteries, that's an industrial thing. Like, where we get our service station, where we buy our gasoline, petrol from now, and a parallel system of charging electric cars has to be introduced somehow. If we could link the power needed to generate that electrical power, can that be done in a way that is highly variable? At home, you might have a thing where the lights that you've got on, and sometimes they're on, sometimes they're not, and we just accept the fact that things are variable. We're mm-hmm. very used to the idea of flicking the switch and there it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like computers, for example, might run on a buffer for a period of time. But when it shuts down, it's got to wait till power comes again. And until then, you can't have your computer. It might be something like that. What that looks like, I don't know.
You are listening to energy and mining expert Dr. Simon Michaud in conversation with Rachel Donald of Planet Critical.
And this is not necessarily uncommon as well. Like, we are very, very spoiled in the West, quote unquote. But South Africa, plenty of rolling, like daily rolling blackouts to manage the energy grid. Like mm-hmm. this is how some countries survive.
Yep, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And we all think that's not our problem. I can see difficulties on multiple fronts here. Society at the moment, for example, is very used to like a just-in-time supply grid. Mm-hmm. And it's economic. The example I like to use is in Edinburgh, they go and fish for salmon in the sea. Right. So the fishermen who go and fish the salmon, they get this lovely salmon. What do? They put it on a boat and send it to Vietnam. In Vietnam, it's put in a tin. The tins are put on another ship and brought back to Edinburgh and put in the supermarket.
Mm.
So the fishermen who fish for the salmon, when they buy food for their families, they go to the supermarket and they buy these tins of salmon. They could go down to a fish market and buy fresh salmon and use that, but mm-hmm. that's not what they do. It makes economic sense to do that because energy is so cheap, it's irrelevant. So we're going to start managing our energy and our material consumption like we manage our money. We are damn careful with our money, and I think it's going to become something like that.
Okay, so we are looking at energy shortages, a decline in energy that is available, a decline in time when energy is available. We're looking at a big energy contraction. Wasn't it, you have the stat that we are currently at a 19-gigawatt society and we need to go down to a 5-gigawatt society?
I think Nate Hagen's had that one. I agree. Right. He had the 19-terawatt society, and he said we need to go to a 10-terawatt society. And I laughed at him and said there's probably going to be 2, maybe 5 if we're lucky.
Right.
Okay. So, because here's the thing. It would be different if we started 40 years ago. And we slowly organize things over time. But we've done nothing. 1% of the electric of the global fleet of vehicles is electric vehicles. That's at 1.1%, right? And renewable energy is still, what, 4 or 5% of the primary energy pie. We've done nothing, right? So what that means is the whole non-fossil fuel system hasn't been built yet.
Yeah.
We just haven't done it yet. And things are about to go seriously inelastic economically. Mm. It's an opinion, right? But by the end of this year, we could find ourselves in a kinetic shooting war, east versus west, as in Russia and China versus everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, ethics aside, we are dependent on both of those countries for everything we actually need. And so we've allowed ourselves to be in a conflict without making ourselves self-sufficient first.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means, we want to buy, 100 million electric vehicles and, say, 10,000 wind turbines. Where does that all come from? China. Who makes their stuff? China. Who does the mining? China.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We don't have the money now, but be nice to us. Hang on. No, that's not going to work either. And so this stuff's not going to be available on the market.
Yeah.
And so we're going to have like a step down, even if we got serious and said, right, we now want 10,000 wind turbines. The time it would take the Chinese to deliver on that is years. It takes time to make this stuff. They've only got so much capacity to start pumping stuff out. And if we're not going to get along, they're not going to give it to us.
Absolutely. What about our engineering know-how and our industrial manufacturing capacity?
Okay, sure. So we have to develop a local capacity in the British Isles. Right across the British Isles, you have a history of mining. But mining's considered dirty and filthy and unenvironmental. You don't do mining anymore. You depend on it for somewhere else.
You offset.
How long would it take for you to establish a mining industry in the British Isles again? And so, well, if you got serious, you're talking 10, 15, 20 years. So it takes that long to build this stuff.
Yeah.
On top of that, now you've got to have the ability to smelt the stuff into metals. At the moment, we get the Chinese to do all that. How long would it take to build the smelters? Again, 15 years, maybe. And then on top of that, so you've got a lot of manufacturing capability in the UK. And in fact, there is a plan I'm putting forward that Finland, what's the size of the circular economy? That could be right across the Nordic frontier countries, but we need a dance partner. And I'm proposing the UK is that dance partner. So the Nordic frontier can tie up the one end of the value chain from mining to chemicals, out to refining chemicals and metals, but we don't have any manufacturing capacity.
Right.
The UK has the manufacturing capacity, but you have shut down and atrophied your resource sector.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we can actually take up one end and you take up the other end and we do business.
Right.
And now that you're outside the EU, you're actually easier to deal with. Right. So.
I think that's the first time anybody said that sentence ever.
Well, okay. Look, I've been burned at the stake for less, so we'll see how that goes. It will take time if the UK decides to get real and actually sort of build its own capability. We're talking years, 15, maybe 20 years, maybe more. Things are about to get real between the West and the East in the next few months. So we're down to months. And we tend to do stupid stuff like we throw economic sanctions around. And I don't believe there are any good guys in that conversation. We're all doing dodgy stuff, all of us. Who blew up the Nord Stream pipeline?
Right? Who indeed?
asking for a friend. Because whoever did that, they've guaranteed that Europe is now in a situation where it must be committed to a military action that it cannot actually win.
Take and maintain energy dominance, because it's the United States that is now like rerouting the natural gas route and like making sure that that Europe has got enough and essentially indebting Europe in some way, and making them rely on the energy streams that they now depend on. Now that the Russian energy stream is out of the picture, Europe very much depends on the United States for energy supply. Is that not correct? So,
Europe at large has been thrown under the bus to maintain the dollar system. And I'm getting phone calls from the people I know in the German civil service who are, there's a very tense internal conversation going on. And the problem they've got is all models for the future of, that they've got have crashed. And now there's a very bitter dispute about which paradigm should go forward now. Do we go back to nuclear? Do we open coal mines again? Do we somehow magic up some solar panels and wind turbines? They don't know what to do. And they just don't. That conversation I had with them was about 8-9 months ago. I don't know what they did.
Right.
But they're an increasingly desperate situation. A lot of industry in Europe has worked out, well, we can't operate here because our gas supply has been weaponized. And so now they're going to the United States, and the United States wrote the Inflation Act about the same time that Europe, mm-hmm. Europe was convinced to apply the sanctions. Okay. So we've been Ocean's 11 by our own allies. And they're saying things like, come to us, set your operations up in America, and they want their industry back, and we will never hold you to ransom for your supply of gas. You're welcome.
Okay, so in all that you're saying, Europe is in a particularly weak position of the developed world. And of course, like, this conversation has not particularly engaged with the problems in the global south, which are resource rich, but have been sort of manipulated into low value added manufacturing and deliberately denied the capacity to become independent and sovereign and all this kind of thing.
Yep.
But in the Western world, Europe's in the shit, essentially.
Yes, but it's not clear who's manipulating who. And I think everyone's doing dodgy stuff. Peak oil was a thing that was projected to destroy society because, you know, oil was much richer than gas calorifically. So your energy return on energy invested, it'll be lower. Mm-hmm. And we're now building in a very, very structural inefficiency into the gas industry. But they're holding it together, and so it's possible our total liquids consumption could beat the 2018 record. Oil has contracted, and I don't think it's coming back.
Yeah. Nobody I speak to thinks it's coming back. All right. So we're in a pretty bad way. We don't have enough staff. We don't have enough capacity. We don't have very many friends. And even for those of us living in this part of the world, used to lives of huge luxury, those luxuries are going to go, and rightly so, because they're built off the backs of exploitation and extraction. But our policymakers are sort of seemingly blind to what's going on because it would demand a massive overhaul of the status quo. However, I understand that you are working on a model called the resource-balanced economy to present to them. Could you walk us through that?
Right. So the Swedish government they asked me directly and says, okay, could you, because I'm part of a group called the Circular Economy Solutions within the Geological Survey. And so we've got our hands on what we call the circular economy. And it says, could you redesign that circular economy in context of your work? That is, we're about to lose fossil fuels. We don't have enough resources to do the green transition, et cetera. What do we do? And so I find it's futile to try and sort of dictate what the future will be. Like, so, right? So what I've done is try to understand the boundary conditions of what the future might be and to understand where we put our effort. Instead of actually flogging yourself trying to prevent a problem, put your energy on what will thrive and work in the solution set, and then that will override everything else. So, industrially, where will things likely to work? If we've got the twin problems that we don't have enough energy and raw materials as well, and a particular stuff arriving on the market, in Australia, we get hit with natural disasters every now and then. And what we do when you have an emergency is everyone puts aside their normal mode of operation, and the society comes together and we say, so we will now do what is necessary to see to the needs of those societies. So in an emergency context, something we really need to have happen is no longer available. What do we do? It's almost like a wartime problem solving or an economic depression problem solving. Do we collectively sit on our butts and wait for it to get better? Or do we realize that this is not getting better, we've got to fix it. And to fix it, we've got to build something else that we've not seen before. Mm-hmm. And once we collectively understand that, right, the transport sector will take the biggest hit. In Finland, for example, 80% of our electricity is already coming from non-fossil fuels. And we've got a heavy industry system of smelters and refineries that are actually already operating on non-fossil fuels. But most of the transport sector is fossil fuels. the tap gets turned off or becomes very volatile, or the government says this is now so expensive and we don't have a lot now that we're going to start talking rationing. It's going to be a rough learning curve, but transport will contract, energy use will contract, people will adapt. And so we'll become a low energy society. Where do we get our food from is a big problem. And so we've got to get off petrochemical fertilizers anyway.
Yeah.
But it would have been preferable not to do it like this. And conventional industrial agriculture is a problem.
Yeah.
So this is the idea where I believe society is going to split into four basic paradigms. And so, you know, how do we respond to this? And which of those paradigms are actually going to be useful?
And what are the four?
Okay. So this is an idea that I put together. First one is the cornucopians. These are the people who believe it'll be fine. Someone will think of something. It'll work out. We're not really in much trouble. It's all good.
Okay.
And the people who refuse to actually engage in this conversation at all, people who want to keep the existing fossil fuel system going, people who believe, for example, that the green transition in its current form is what we do, you know, most of the people working in the oil industry believe electric vehicles will come online and make everything so cheap that oil will become obsolete. And they all drive Teslas, right? So they see this as an economic problem.
Yeah.
Right. But they don't want to hear about resource limits.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't do anything with these people. Wave goodbye. See ya. Go and don't, like don't. I found out the hard way. It's so much easier to go and work with like-minded people than to try and convince people of things they don't want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Second group is a group I call the Vikings. Although when I was talking to Amanda Scott the other day, she said she prefers to call them the pirates. These are people who realize the wheels are falling off and it's getting tough. But instead of going through the hard work of making a new system, let's just go and take stuff from someone else.
Okay.
And
The raiders.
And so, yeah, that's a good word for it. So let's go and take stuff from someone else. The problem is there comes a point when there's no more stuff to take, or their ability to go and take becomes very difficult because they don't have, like, you know, fuel to move around in the same way anymore.
Yeah.
And now this is a mentality we're seeing at all levels, including nation state levels.
Yeah.
There's this idea of predation. Instead of doing things collectively and can we make a better solution? No. Let's try and take stuff off each other. The third group is the group that I call the prepper community. And so these are the people who understand the wheels are falling off. Our normal systems that we normally operate with are not doing so well. And then they will step up and take care of business to make sure that the needs of society are looked to. And they do things like grow their own food. They'll manage their own sewage sanitation. They'll manage their own water supply. They'll either go without power generation or they'll generate their own power. You know, that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll use problem solving from any different sector. It doesn't have to be pretty as long as it works.
Okay.
The fourth group is a group I call the Arcadians. And they are the group that actually looks 100 years into the future or something like that. And it says, how do we build a new society that's genuinely wise, where humanity has learned everything it needs to learn and we can actually be genuinely sustainable? And you have the harmonious merging of people, the social contract, the environment in all its forms and all its scales, and what technology we have available.
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like?
Mm-hmm.
And so, there's groups like the Venus Project and Jacques Fresco that's been thinking about that since the 70s, but a lot of the work done thus far has not recognized the material shortages or the energy shortages.
Right, okay.
And so the way forward for me is you take something like the Venus Project and you integrate it into the prepper community.
Yeah.
What would happen if the prepper community were handed some disruptive technology?
Mm.
That was able to recognize the commodity shortfalls that would change everything. We've got to fix our relationship with the environment, and we've got to do it at all levels, and it's got to be done the way we live.
If you loved it, support Planet Critical on Patreon, where you can also read my weekly essays inspired by each podcast. Thank you all for listening.
Go to planetcritical.com to learn more and subscribe.
This conversation between Rachel Donald of Planet Critical and Dr. Simon Michaud was edited for radio by Mariah Gallardin of TUC Radio, first half hour, and Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, second half hour. My thanks to Mariah and Rachel for making this essential information available. Rachel Donald is on Substack at www.planetcritical.com. You can support Rachel's work in independent climate journalism on Patreon. Find my notes on the Simon Michaud talk in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Our time is up. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Just a little story from Penn State geologist Richard Alley.
Now, come a little farther forward in time. We're now in the Saurian sauna of the mid-Cretaceous. It's still hot. There's no ice near sea level at the poles anywhere. You have balmy temperatures. You have forests crowding up to the edge of the Arctic Ocean. The continents are not that different from now. And if you put them in a model, as has been done, you know, a little, you melt all the ice and the sea level gets a little higher and that changes the planet's albedo a little and you get a little bit of warming and you move the currents around and you might a little bit of warming with some configurations, you can't get much. And so it's really stinking hot, and the only explanation we can find on this is that CO2 is really high again. And probably because volcanism is running pretty fast. If you put high CO2 in the models, you sort of match what happened, except that the world seems a little bit too warm at the poles. If you leave the CO2 out of the models, you don't get very close. The only way we can attribute this warmth of having an ice-free world is to have a high CO2.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
Canadian one-man band Shane Phillip.